This episode of The Energy Gang is brought to you by Hitachi Energy. If you're enjoying this conversation, you should check out our podcast, Power Pulse, where we explore the transformation of the world's energy systems. Visit us at hitachienergy.com/powerpulse.
Hello, and welcome to The Energy Gang, a discussion show about the fast-changing world of energy. I'm Dr. Melissa Lott, the Director of Research at Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy, and a regular contributor here on The Energy Gang. Ed's on holiday again this week and asked if I could step in to host while he's away from the mic. And today, I'm going to be joined once again by Robbie Orvis, Senior Director for Energy Policy Design at Energy Innovation. Hey, Robbie, how you doing?
Hey, Melissa. I am doing well. Lots to talk about today. Lots happening in the U.S.
No doubt. I heard a rumor that we both tried to be on holidays at the same time when the Senate Democrats found that path forward for some major energy and climate legislation in the U.S. Is that about right? Were you on holiday, like trying to take a breath?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it was so dead, I left my computer at home. So that was really fun.
Oh, man, that must have been something to come back to. Well, also joining Robbie and I today is Dr. Linus Mofor, who for the past nearly 8 years has served as the Senior Natural Resources Officer for Energy, Infrastructure, and Climate Change at the African Climate Policy Center, which is part of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa. Hi, Linus. Welcome to the show. And before we get started, I thought it'd be great if you could just share a bit about your background, which is really fascinating, and the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Melissa. It's a great pleasure to be here with you on the Energy Gang for my first time. So as you say, I'm a Senior Environmental Affairs Officer at the African Climate Policy Center of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa based in Addis Ababa. I've been here now for 8 years, getting to 8 years. Before that, I was with the International Renewable Energy Agency, IRENA, in the Technology Center in Bonn, in Germany. And before that, I was with the United Nations Industrial Development Organization in Vienna. But before that, I spent a lot of time in academia in the UK, where I was teaching, researching, and consulting in the field of environment.
That's awesome. As someone who did their PhD in the UK, I'm smiling. The listeners can't see that part of smiling when you mentioned your time in the UK, right. which I knew about. Well, I'll say, Linus, Robbie, I've been really looking forward to today's discussion. I was thinking about it over the weekend before we do this recording, on Monday as the week's kicking off to start. And there was honestly so many topics that we could cover and so many different ways we could approach all the things that are going on in different parts of the world, here in the U.S., in different countries in Africa, et cetera. But I really want to start our discussion today with this topic that I think it's fair to say it's been at the top of our minds, top of headlines when it comes to the energy sector in the United States. It's certainly grabbed the attention of many around the world as well. And it's a topic that Ed and Amy Myers Jaffe and Paula Gant actually spoke about briefly in the last episode of The Energy Gang. And for those listeners who haven't already got it, yep, I'm talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, IRA, whatever you want to say. I've been saying IRA, not to be confused with some retirement plans that are out there. But last week, President Biden approved the IRA, stating that this bill is the biggest step forward on climate change ever, and it's going to allow us to boldly take additional steps towards meeting all of our climate goals. And in a press release from the White House, they cited some emissions that this act will result in terms of reductions of greenhouse gases, talking about 1 gigaton, so that's a billion metric tons of reductions in 2030. And they said that this is 10 times more positive climate impact than any other single piece of legislation that has ever been enacted. And I will say that for me personally, and also for a lot of us that have been working on energy and climate, this act was perhaps, Robbie, can we say the surprise of the summer? I mean, I wasn't betting on it, at least. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, it's been quite the roller coaster ride. Happy to be off of it now. But like you said, we were all on vacation after things looked pretty bleak. And yet here we are a few weeks later.
Yeah. And I'll say, in addition to it being a bit of a surprise for the summer, I will say it's a high point after decades of work pulling together, you know, pieces of major energy and climate legislation. I mean, we've had some runs at goal, and this one's actually in the net. And that's pretty cool. That's a pretty big deal for those of us who are focused on how do we drive down the country's emissions to help mitigate the impacts of climate change and also protect public health. And I will say that there's an interesting thing going on here where the impacts will be felt directly in the United States, but it's also fair to say that the impacts of this legislation will be felt well beyond our borders in a bunch of ways that I hope we talk about today, but also in terms of reducing emissions and protecting health of those outside of this country. I also want to highlight just really briefly that itself won't just impact energy and climate. It'll also impact many other types of air pollution that I personally study in my own research. So things like particulate matter that's produced by burning fossil fuels, according to some of the initial analysis that I've been going through, we're looking at avoiding nearly 4,000 premature deaths and up to 100,000 asthma attacks annually by 2030. I'll highlight that a bunch of those asthma attacks happen in young children who are still, you know, developing their lungs that will be faced potentially with chronic health conditions moving forward because of the air pollution they're exposed to at a young age. So while this is really heavily about energy and climate, it's also about public health outside of climate change. There's a public health impact within climate change, but also stuff outside of there. I'll say, Robbie, I think some of those numbers might have come from y'all, actually, that I was reading over the past week or so here. Is that right? Am I remembering this right?
That is right. Yeah. I'm happy to dive into those some more and talk about what it all means today.
Absolutely. Well, let's step right into that. So as a bit of background, Robbie, I really want to turn to you with just a couple different questions. So what did this bill that's now signed into law, that President Biden has now signed off on, what does it include? What did it leave out? And, you know, where do we go from here now that it's reality, not just a discussion point?
Well, first, I just want to say I am so excited to be here today, finally getting to have this episode talking about the bill. I don't think I've escaped a discussion of it on any of the episodes I've been on. And here we are. So yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act has $369 billion for climate and clean energy. For context, the bill that passed the House of Representatives in the fall, that had $555 billion. And so that's just one kind of benchmark. But what we'll talk about is that actually a lot of the emissions reductions that groups like mine, Energy Innovation, and others have been modeling, those numbers didn't change a whole lot from the fall to where we are now. And that can be a bit surprising, but it points to the process through which this bill has been subjected and all of the analytics, I think, that went into it, that went into getting it to where it is. So broadly speaking, there's a lot in the bill for clean energy deployment. We have tax credits for clean electricity, both investment and production tax credits that ultimately transition to technology neutral tax credits. And that will allow technologies that currently aren't eligible to qualify in the future. So if we get those advanced nuclear reactors or we get enhanced geothermal, you know, pretty soon here, those will all be able to get those tax credits. There are tax credits for vehicles, both for personal vehicles and for commercial vehicles. We have tax credits for building electrification and building efficiency. You know, you name it, hydrogen production, sustainable aviation fuels, biofuels, industrial decarbonization, clean manufacturing. The bill is just filled with all of these programs. And again, looking at kind of what's in there versus what was in there in the fall, a lot of the programs that were key to those emissions reductions in the fall, those are still in there. They might have been tweaked a little. But that is why, broadly speaking, the three groups that have done modeling of the bill across its entirety, you know, including Rhodium and Princeton, and then our work at Energy Innovation, we're all kind of landing on that 40% reduction relative to 2005 levels in 2030.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw it, Robbie, but there was this article from Amy Harder over at Cypher that made me smile because I was thinking about, just like you were saying, how is this different from Build Back Better, from where we were, you know, last year, from where discussions have evolved since then? And the title of her article was "Forget Sticks, Congress Embraces Carrots to Tackle Climate Change." I think it sums a lot of it up, though, from what I'm seeing. Does that seem fair to you?
Yeah.
You agree with Amy and kind of how she characterizes it?
Definitely. Yeah, I think and that might be one of the key differences this time around that someday someone will probably write a book about, or at least a PhD thesis about what finally got this over the finish line. But definitely the bill is focused on making clean energy cheap and onshoring the production of clean energy technologies in the U.S. And that seems to be the right mix of things that got us across the finish line.
So I've got one question before, Linus, I turn to you. But Robbie, one other thing that I've been reading more and more about before everything passed and as it's gone through, you know, the Senate and the House and to the president's desk was, the bill isn't just all about clean energy or zero carbon energy, is it? So there are some, you know, aspects of it that do play in fossil fuels, security, near-term needs as we transition. Do you mind just touching on that for a minute?
That's a really good question. There are a lot of tax credits and programs for deploying clean energy technologies, but there's also a handful of things in the bill related to different types of fuels. So there's a sustainable aviation fuel tax credit and a tax credit for clean biofuels. And then there's been a lot of focus on some of the particular provisions in the bill related to oil and gas leasing. And just to quickly kind of recap those. So the bill now ties lease auctions for renewable energy development on federal land. And so in particular, that means if an administration wants to hold a lease auction, say for offshore wind rights of way, they have to also have held an auction in the previous year for at least 60 million acres of land offshore. And there's a similar requirement for onshore leasing of 2 million acres. And so there's been, you know, a lot of concern about what that means for continued oil and gas development, particularly in the context of, you know, the IEA's 1.5 scenario, which shows we shouldn't be having any oil and gas development. I think it is challenging to know exactly what that means in terms of production and emissions. If we look historically, pretty small share of offshore lease auctions have actually converted to lease issuances, something like 2% of the land. And then from there, an even smaller share goes into production. The number is a little bit higher for onshore, but the acreage is much, much smaller. And so you take that, and then you also consider that if we do get the emissions reductions that the modeling studies envision from the Inflation Reduction Act, that's a big decrease in natural gas demand in the US, and likewise, a significant reduction in demand for things like gasoline and diesel. And those markets are very often determined by demand, which drives price and drives supply. So across some of the modeling studies, what we've seen is, you know, in our case, we tried to look at kind of a worst case scenario. And in some of the other modeling studies, they're showing actually net decreases in production of fossil fuels because of those demand reductions. So I think it's uncertain. It's certainly not aligned with the 1.5 requirements outlined by the IPCC and the International Energy Agency. But whether or not it will lead to increased production in the US and emissions reductions remains to be seen. And in our modeling, you know, we ultimately found that in our updated modeling that for every one ton that this might increase emissions from oil and gas production, both in the US and internationally, we should see at least 28 tons of emissions reductions in the US. So that doesn't mean it's not bad or there's not potential problems with it or it won't lead to issues with frontline communities. But if we're just looking at a greenhouse gas perspective, that's kind of what we're envisioning in a worst case, that we might get 28 reductions for every one ton increase.
Interesting. Really interesting. Linus, I want to turn to you for a moment and ask, I mean, what do you make of this bill? And one of my questions on my mind is, how do you think it's impacted how other countries are viewing the US in the middle of all these decarbonization discussions?
No, thank you. Thank you, Melissa. And thank you, Robbie, for highlighting some of those points. Melissa, I like that title of your friend's article, Congress Forgets Sticks and Embrace Carrots for the IRA. This is really good because this shows leadership of the Biden administration, where you match ambition with pragmatism, right? When you match ambition with pragmatism, then people buy in. Maybe that is what has done the deal. And as Robbie said, the IRA is technology neutral. It's not excluding anything. And then what I found very interesting is this idea that it is saying that when you give to renewables this, in terms of land, federal land lease, also give to oil and gas that. Of course, it doesn't mean that they have to use it. This is the pragmatism that African countries have been calling for, Melissa. You know, before the crisis in Ukraine, we had the European Green Deal. Then eventually, Europe said, oh, we were going to look at natural gas as a clean energy source. But at the same time, the developed countries were saying that nobody should be investing in gas, which makes sense in Africa as a way of transitioning through to more renewables, right? So the IRA is the kind of a deal which I think now African countries will be saying, this is what we've been saying before. Let's be ambitious, but let's be ambitious in a very pragmatic, practical way, because as Robbie has said, their modeling has shown that even though you're giving room for oil and gas, but this IRA is going to lead to more emission reductions than would have been otherwise the case, right? And you said, Robbie, that you're going to have 40% reduction of emissions by 2030 compared to what it would have been. I think it was usually going to be 26% or so. So this is where ambition is matched by pragmatism, and we have a sensible way forward. Just like African countries say that if they invest in natural gas as a way of bringing more renewables, because they have a very weak base generation, they have weak grid infrastructure, and so on. Therefore, you can use natural gas as a way of having dispatchable power in addition to hydro. Then that way you can have more variable wind, more variable solar. You can bring in more renewables than you would otherwise have done.
So it sounds like from what you're saying that overall, this is a really positive thing in the view of the nations that you work most closely with today, you know, saying, hey, we need pragmatic solutions. We need practical pathways forward to reducing emissions. And
right.
This is a sign of something like that. Does that sound about right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So one of the other comments I've been hearing from some of my European colleagues, don't know if either one of y'all has a view on this, is that these types of pathways forward, they also result often the modeling in near-term emissions reductions. And if you look at the IPCC, if you look at the big modeling studies out there, those near-term reductions are so important to giving us that, you know, increased chance of hitting anything close to 1.5 or 2 degrees. And the idea of, you know, we used to say, oh, well, we'll wait for some technology improvements and that'll be a cheaper pathway forward if we just wait a little bit longer. And actually the studies have come through really strongly saying, no, we have the technologies we need and it will just actually be more expensive later if we delay. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on any of that, Linus? I don't know if you have any thoughts or comments on what I'm saying.
Absolutely, Melissa. I fully subscribe to that. The solution to climate change is a policy thing. It's not a technology thing. It's a policy thing. And I think what the IRA has done, what the European Green Deal has done, what China's policy are doing, and what African policies are doing are exactly that. It's about policy. You have the right policy and that support, we have the technologies, it will happen. But we really need seriousness and commitment at the policy level to deal with this. Yeah.
I'll just add, I think I agree completely with that. You know, the technologies have come down, some of the major ones, so far in cost that it's, you know, to Linus's point, it's policy now to drive it. The other interesting thing about the IRA is it has some of the necessary pieces to help bring down those technology costs in the future for those sectors where we might need them. You know, we've talked about the role for hydrogen on the podcast before, you know, $3 a kilogram. I saw a chart from Bloomberg New Energy Finance that could easily cover the gap and make hydrogen very cheap, if not actually being subsidized by 2030. And, you know, there's the 45Q tax credit, which is for carbon capture and storage and also for direct air capture. And you mentioned, you know, sustainable aviation fuels. So the interesting thing about the bill is it scales up those technologies by 2030 to get to 40%. And then it kind of sets us on that path to further develop and commercialize those technologies to close the rest of the gap. I mean, probably won't do it on its own, but it can really help catalyze important investment in those industries, drive down the cost of those technologies.
I feel like there's a number of things that I found very interesting and exciting because it feels like it's very much informed by the research and the evidence base that we've been talking about in the IRA, which is two things. One, this technology agnostic approach, like we need all these solutions on the table if we want to have a chance of getting emissions done as quickly as possible. It's not, you know, the silver bullet concept. I mean, what is it? Some people in Texas like to say it's actually silver buckshot. I mean, the point is you actually just need a lot of things. You don't just need one. But then also that it does create space for improving technologies over time. So it creates that technology neutral approach. It says we need all these things at the table, give space for essentially everything to play. I know there are some things that were left out. I've been talking to some of my industry colleagues about, you know, what wasn't addressed in this. And, you know, it wasn't everything, but it was a lot of stuff. And it certainly wasn't, you know, two favorite technologies and that's all that gets through. It was a hodgepodge of stuff. It was a full buffet, you know, pick your favorites. Like we got a whole table full of options. So something I found really interesting in this is that it didn't also just focus on one or two supply technologies. So it's not just about the panel that gets installed or the wind turbine that gets put in a field or the battery that hits the road, but it actually leaned into looking at the supply chains that go into each of those things. And I wonder how much Russia's invasion of Ukraine actually affected that part of this conversation and what actually came through in the final thing that hit the president's desk. And to be clear, I'm talking about the pieces in this that are talking about critical minerals. I think it's a really important point in all this that we haven't touched on too deeply yet, and I'd like to dive into a bit more. So in the IRA, they extend and expand those existing electric vehicle subsidies. Robbie, you talked a lot about the subsidies that are included in this, all those carrots that Amy talks about in her article. But also it factors in the source of the critical materials that are going into the battery packs themselves in those electric vehicles. So I'm talking about the lithium, the nickel, the cobalt, the manganese. This bill requires at least, 40% of these critical metals must come from the United States or a free trade agreement partner. And then that percentage actually rises to 80% in 2026, which is, I mean, that's a blink of an eye. That's like 4 years, not even from now. I mean, it's right around the corner. And I think it's fair to say that that's no small deal. And I know it's gained the attention of automakers and battery manufacturers, as well as the entire supply chain that goes into those processes. And I got this quote that was actually from Senator Manchin, that when we're talking about these supply chains and critical materials, he said, I think it was, quote, "We need to get aggressive and make sure that we're extracting in North America and we're processing in North America, and that we put a line on China." And by all accounts, from what I'm hearing, Robbie, please correct me if you're hearing something differently here, but by all accounts, he was actually the primary architect of this minerals sourcing component of the EV subsidy scheme. And I think it sends a bunch of different signals, but the impacts of it are well beyond China. You know, we're talking about United States or a free trade agreement partner being able to supply that 40% going to 80%. So I'll turn to you, Robbie, first. Do you agree this seems like a pretty big deal, or at least a really clear signal?
Yeah, definitely. And we should unpack a bit about the EV tax credit, because there is an awful lot in there, and it is hard to quite decipher what it all means. But I think just stepping back for a minute, the IRA is an industrial policy bill. And especially when you look at it combined with the CHIPS bill that President Biden signed and the infrastructure bill, I mean, these are pieces of legislation that are designed to remake American manufacturing for a 21st century economy. And that is why, you know, the bill has a ton of money for clean energy manufacturing. There's a advanced clean energy tax credit for the production of things like solar PV and for batteries. There's funding to help convert the auto manufacturing industry. And so you look at that, you look at the way in which, for example, the tax credits have bonus amounts tied to how much domestic content is used. I mean, this bill is really about growing the U.S. clean energy manufacturing industry. And yeah, the tax credits for EVs are perhaps one of the best examples of that. So one of the, you know, final pieces of the bill that we have now is this change to the EV tax credit. And so just for folks who are new and haven't learned about kind of the existing, or I guess they're no longer existing, the previous electric vehicle tax credits, there was previously a $7,500 tax credit for electric vehicles. Once a manufacturer sold 200,000 of those vehicles, the credit phased out. And so, you know, folks like Tesla and GM, they no longer have that tax credit. Now in the new bill, there is a rather complicated personal vehicle tax credit. It includes two pieces, each one of which is $3,750. One is for domestic assembly, which means US assembly of batteries, and the other is for this critical minerals piece that you mentioned, which requires that by dollar percentage, some amount of the critical minerals starting at 40% and going up to 80% are sourced from the US or from countries that the US has a free trade agreement with. There is also one other piece, which has gotten some reporting, but probably not enough, which is this requirement that starting in 2024, and then ramping up in 2025, that none of the contents of the battery are sourced from entities of concern, which is a legal concept defined in the US code, but notably includes China. And what it means is that starting in 2024 and then expanding in 2025, if any elements of the battery, meaning literal elements or components of the battery, I should say, are produced by, processed in, extracted from China, the vehicle no longer qualifies as a clean vehicle, meaning it gets $0. And so all of that, coupled with the scaling critical minerals requirements and all the funding in the bill, is really geared towards getting at Senator Manchin's concerns about needing to not be so reliant on China and countries we don't have trade agreements with for these key minerals and other battery components. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of concern on the timeline that is very, very fast to ramp that in. And from what I've read, you know, once you start putting steel in the ground, the fastest you can build a minerals processing plant is maybe 3 to 4 years. So there's pretty clearly not enough time to grow that industry at the scale that's needed before those provisions kick in. But the incentives are all aligned in the long run to really bring those industries to the US and to North America, with the idea being to increase our energy security and reduce our dependence, especially on Chinese, you know, mineral extraction and processing. So that has made it very challenging for people who are looking to buy EVs in terms of how to interpret what it means for them. But that is kind of the broad goal of the tax credit, the way it's currently written.
And I'll say this type of requirement, I think it's fair to say it puts a pretty definitive, clear, and significant international spin on what, at least on the surface, could have been considered a domestic energy and climate agenda. I think if you dig into it, there's always been an international component of this. Like, the US is not, you know, an island operating on its own when it comes to all the supply chains going to this. But I mean, it's clear and definitive. I want to turn to you, Linus. How do you think about these types of provisions and how they could work and what this could play out and look like when it comes to different countries in Africa that you work with?
No, interesting, Melissa. I think what Senator Manchin is saying is also what we are hearing from African leaders on the continent at the moment. He says they have to extract in America, process in America. We are also hearing African leaders say they have to now start extracting in Africa and start processing in Africa. I think of the top 15 countries with critical minerals, 8 of them are in Africa. And you take the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example. It accounts for 70% of the global supply of cobalt, but it only captures 3% of the value. And so what the leaders are saying now, they have to start using the abundant clean energy resources on the continent to transform these critical minerals on the continent to start producing the battery precursors and so on. And that is why, in fact, the Democratic Republic of Congo requested the Economic Commission for Africa and other regional entities like the African Development Bank, the Afrexim Bank, and the African Finance Corporation to convene what is called the DRC Africa Business Forum last year, where the whole idea was, how do you extract these minerals in Africa and process them in Africa to start producing battery precursors? So these entities, we commissioned a study with Bloomberg. And that study showed that, in fact, you could produce in DRC, especially if you leverage the Africa Continental Free Trade, where you have the other minerals coming from other countries like Tanzania, Madagascar, Zambia, and so on. You could produce battery precursors in DRC at 30% cheaper than you would in the US, and the same 30% cheaper than you would in China. So if the IRA is also requiring that to fill the gap, that any vehicle that is produced with components, clean energy, battery components that are coming from entities of concern, and you mentioned, Robbie, China, then it means that this is a huge opportunity for this processing, extracting and processing in Africa, right? Because America, the US has a strong trade agreement, AGOA, with Africa. It means that we now need to be able to support African countries to start doing the extracting and processing in Africa to sell to US as a friendly trading partner to close the gap that is needed in the IRA.
Thanks for that, Linus. I think it's really important points. And I want to pivot in a moment to the broader discussion about Africa's energy transition, the role in the global energy transition, COP27. I mean, there's just a lot to unpack there. But before we actually transition off this topic, Robbie, I want to come back to something we were talking about earlier, closer to the top of the show, which is around the health benefits and health impacts. And then also something we haven't touched on, which is around jobs. What is the modeling telling us when it comes to those numbers, the potential impacts of this? I mean, what is called the Inflation Reduction Act, but is really so much more and different than that?
Yeah. So those health impacts you cited are from some of our research. So it won't come as a surprise to folks that as we reduce our carbon emissions, we're also going to be reducing our emissions of nasty pollutants like particulates and things that lead to particulate pollution like SOx and NOx. And so we're finding, more than 4,000 avoided premature deaths by 2030. So those are just in 2030, and those grow and continue to grow over time as we avoid burning those, the dirtiest fossil fuels. And then likewise, you know, more than 100,000 asthma attacks. And we actually, in some forthcoming research, we've got a lot of different health indicators that we're going to include all of the data on. So you can see all those different things like avoided hospital visits and avoided heart attacks and so on. And so a lot of health benefits from the bill. We also tend to find that given where energy infrastructure is located, those benefits do tend to be located in communities of color or more heavily concentrated in communities of color. So really important benefits there. We talked about some of the concerns from the oil and gas leasing provisions. So there's more work to be done for sure to make sure that as funding is rolled out from the bill, that it's done so in an equitable and just way. And then, on jobs, we're finding 1.2 to 1.3 million jobs in 2030. Those are net job increases in 2030 as a result of the bill. And it's no surprise. I mean, we are talking about significantly growing U.S. clean manufacturing, and then we just have to deploy a lot of stuff. And so there's a lot of construction jobs, a lot of manufacturing jobs, and then a lot of, you know, the technical and legal services jobs that are required to support all of that. So this is a bill with health benefits and greenhouse gas benefits, energy benefits. We're finding about $80 per year in reduced household energy costs by 2030. So really a lot to like.
This episode of the Energy Gang is brought to you by Hitachi Energy. If you're enjoying this conversation, you should check out Hitachi Energy's own podcast, Power Pulse, where we explore the transformation of the world's energy systems to advance a sustainable energy future for all. Recent episodes focus on opportunities for offshore wind in the U.S., the unique contributions of women to the energy industry, and the challenge of meeting EV fleet charging demand. Visit us at hitachienergy.com/powerpulse.
Well, I'll say there was an article that came out written by my colleague Jason Bordoff, the director of our center. It came out late last week, and it highlighted, to the point you just made, Robbie, about just the amount of stuff that needs to happen now that this is in place. There's a lot of reforms around expediting permits and approvals. And, you know, I wish we just had hours to go into that and all the non-technical barriers. But another thing he highlighted in the article I thought was really important. It was about foreign policy. And I'll just quote it really quick before I go into a series of questions for the two of y'all. In this article, Jason says, "But Biden's crowning domestic policy achievement will not reach its full potential without the hard work of the nation's diplomats. Foreign policy is critical to the success of the IRA's climate policies on everything from avoiding a trade war to ensuring manufacturers have the nickel, cobalt, lithium, and other commodities needed to make all those solar panels and batteries." So Linus, what you were talking about, how do we make sure we get the materials we need? And Robbie, you were talking about the timelines to achieve these ambitious goals. So these quotes and the things that Jason is writing about in this discussion is making me think about November and the COP in Egypt. So the Conference of the Parties, COP27, I think it's fair to say that the U.S. is going to be in a distinctly different position at this year's COP. President Biden and his team are going to be coming to the table with passed binding policy. It's imperfect, sure, but it's a major milestone. And when we look at that, you know, nearly $400 billion in federal funding to bring down emissions, that's the largest investment the U.S. has ever made to address climate change. And it's not a discussion. It's not an ambition. It's signed. It's past the president's desk. Like, it's going to happen. It's going to move forward. And as we've just discussed, this policy is going to create some really interesting investment opportunities in the clean energy supply chain around electric vehicles. Robbie, you mentioned green hydrogen, but a lot of others. And so, Linus, I really would love to dig into this a bit deeper. So a few different things on this. So how do you think that this bill will directly affect Africa? And you touched upon the opportunity for different countries within Africa. So you talked about, you know, how this could actually affect, you know, the amount of cobalt that's coming out, et cetera, et cetera. But could you dive into that just a little bit more deeply and how you think about it as we run up to COP?
No, indeed, Melissa, as I said, it really touches onto the idea that Africa no longer is going to be exporting cobalt as a raw mineral, but it is going to be extracting it in Africa and processing it in Africa. So it is a whole industrialization agenda, right? It's where Africa will be producing the precursors that are needed for batteries and the electric future value chain and so on. And so it also then means that Africa is also seeing how can you then address climate change, address energy deficit, build a whole big industry that leverages regional integration through the Africa Continental Free Trade to really drive development on the continent, right? So Africa is no longer going to be where you dig and export and then import produced materials. But Africa is starting to produce and be at the center of the energy transition, global value chains, also at the regional level.
So here's the thing that pops into my mind. Like, it's money. All right, just a preview, spoiler, it's money. Like, so when I think about all this, okay, not just getting the raw materials, refining it and different things that are, you know, extremely valuable and capturing that part of the value chain and the supply chains, are we in a position, like, does IRA help put different countries in Africa in a better position when it comes to having the finance that's needed to build up the infrastructure that's needed to do all the things that we're talking about?
Well, I think that is what I would like to see. And maybe, Robbie, if you see more about it, because it's not quite clear to me what is directly in the IRA for Africa, right? But we did mention this thing at the beginning, where we talked about what constitutes a credible and compelling energy transition narrative. And it's what this IRA is all about. And I think this is what President Obama used to say, that a compelling, credible energy options policy is all of the above. You put all on the table, but of course, they will have different priorities and so on. So I think if the IRA is also now going to start supporting credible investments in Africa that ensure that Africa can do exactly like the IRA is doing, where you have different pathways towards a net zero that include gas in some cases for countries. Different countries have different opportunities, of course. Green hydrogen potential development and all of this, then that would really be very transformative and will make a very successful COP, because this COP is going to be about implementation. So we have to start seeing meaningful, credible implementation ideas that come to the table. But I don't think it will be a successful COP where the US comes with a bill that has been signed for climate action in the country, and then it's giving the impression, and everybody else is giving the impression, that it's one set of rules for one group of people, another set of rules for another group of people, and that would be different. But if we say now this is a blueprint of a credible climate action that is taken at the highest policy level, the investments are there, we can see how much money the US is putting into this, but let's also support other countries to do something similar that is also credible, leads to more jobs, reduces emissions, helps to industrialize and close development gaps on the continent that are quite huge, then that will make a lot of sense.
So one thing that I want to highlight, Linus, that you commented on briefly a moment ago, which is just how these actions in the US, which you've been focusing on, and also actions in the EU coming in the wake of, you know, the Russia-Ukraine war, there's actually some significant actions that are taking place within the African Union as well. And I'm thinking specifically about the announcement that came, I think it was last month, talking about the common position on energy access and the just energy transition. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more for listeners who are not as familiar with the common position. Can you tell us what it includes and its significance as we do get closer to Sharm el-Sheikh for COP27?
So, you know, Africa has got a serious energy paradox, right? The continent has got abundant energy resources, whether you're talking about fossil fuel resources or renewable energy resources, everywhere across the continent. But it is the least energized region in the world. Africa is having 80% of the 730 or so million people globally without access to electricity. It's having 37% of the 2.4 billion people without access to clean cooking. The installed electricity capacity in Africa is around 250 gigawatts. You're talking about 2,000 gigawatts in China, right? And so we expect that Africa can grow, where there's a huge access deficit and so on. If that has to be addressed in a meaningful way, what we need to do is to ensure that there are enough investments to double that capacity to at least 500 gigawatts by 2030 and increase it at least fivefold by 2050. So you're talking about investments of 500 billion by 2030, about 2 trillion by 2050. But what is happening is that at the moment, there's not enough in terms of investments coming to the continent, right? Less than 1.5% of clean energy investments globally come to Africa per year. And that is the story every year. And so with this a huge energy access deficit, very low flows of investment, and the need to really ramp up supply to meet demand and address development gaps, how do you do it? I think you do it in a way that is credible, compelling, and also start looking at how do you mobilize different sources of resources, including resources from within Africa. There is capital in Africa. there is a private sector in Africa, and Africa has actually shown innovation in addressing things in like mobile communications, mobile money. For example, you know, Kenya has given capacity support to other developed countries how to do this. And so the question is, how can we also try now to begin to look at that kind of source, domestic resource mobilization? And that is why at the Economic Commission for Africa, together with the Sustainable Energy for All and the Africa Energy Chamber, we will establish something called Team Energy Africa to bring captains of industry, the private sector, to mobilize resources that can start investing. And then they can leverage the foreign direct investments to come in as well to address this big issue. We will do as much renewable as we can, but we need to do it in a way that is also meaningful, right? Because when people talk about, oh, you know, you have to go 100% renewable, or Africa should stop this and that, how is it going to happen? We have to be pragmatic. We don't have enough base generation on the continent, so how can we bring in more variable wind and solar when there's no dispatchable generation to kick in, when the sun doesn't shine or the wind stop blowing, when you don't have a transmission and distribution infrastructure to take the energy from where it's needed, is being generated where it's needed. So it is the whole package. That is what the common position is saying, is the whole package. We look at all of these issues together, be able to have a meaningful transition that will make Africa to do more renewables faster and at bigger scale than it would otherwise do from a dogmatic thing. So that is why I feel that this IRA is actually a good blueprint that is actually saying exactly what the African common position is saying. And I think there's now convergence, I think, going to COP, that this is the way to go forward. So it's a whole big package that hopefully can also work like the IRA is going to work.
There's so many great points that I wish we had another hour to go through in that. And thank you for stepping us through it. I'll just pick up on one, which we've talked about on the show a number of times, because it applies to countries around the world, to all of us in different ways, which is this idea of dispatchable generation. If electricity is the backbone of so much of what we want to do, we need to have a mix of things if we want to keep it affordable and reliable, which both are key, right? And within that, variable renewables, absolutely. Energy storage, yes, that too, but also dispatchable generation. And for that, I mean, there's not that many different technologies that actually get us there. So hydro, if you know the water's flowing and everything, that can do to a point. But then natural gas with CCS over time, so replacing some of that with hydrogen, nuclear. I mean, there's a few technologies that really provide that for us. And I think it's just a really important point, as are the... I'm just going to stop myself there because I want to start pulling threads. And I'm realizing I'm looking at the clock, and unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time for today. So I'm going to pivot us into free electrons, because that's one thing that I know is a highlight of the show each week. And I certainly want to hear what y'all have for your free electrons this week. So Robbie, I'm going to pass it over to you. What's your free electron this week? What you've been reading? What you looking at?
Yeah, well, I guess as the family scholar on the IRA, I'm already being drawn into the discussions about how to interpret everything, which you'd think after spending a year on it, I'd have a better handle on. But man, some of the provisions are complicated. So my parents-in-law are both trying to install a heat pump and mm-hmm. also getting a plug-in hybrid. And so I have been trying to assist them and on emails with the electrician and the dealership, trying to help them make sure they don't miss the window on the EV tax credits, but then also trying to understand how to interpret the building tax credits. And one thing I learned is that you want to get a heat pump. There's a nice $2,000 tax credit for them to do that, but the level of efficiency required, 18 SEER, is apparently very hard to find on the market. And so I've already been learning about all of the implementation questions that will be raised, and how the IRS, you know, aside from their new agents that's been in the news, how they are going to go about setting guidance for all of these things and figuring out, you know, what vehicles are in, what pieces of equipment are in, and what's out. And man, they're going to have their hands full trying to translate the IRA into actual rules for everyday folks to follow. So that's been a fun learning experience. And it's always interesting going from, you know, modeling legislation to actually then doing it in the real world and understanding how it works is a big leap sometimes.
That's great. Linus, how about you? Free electrons for this week. What are you reading? What are you looking at?
Well, thank you, Melissa. So for the free electron, it's about this issue of investment. I've been thinking about this for years, right? And in fact, I actually wrote something about it on my LinkedIn page, because we've talked about these scales of investments that are needed. Where would the money come from? I said, what if, I know that Melissa, when you finish now, Robbie, when you're going home, on the way home, if you lose $100, you lose $200. When you reach home, you realize, oh, I dropped $100. You will feel a bit upset, but you will still have the dinner that you wanted to have. You will still probably have the wine, the bottle of wine that you wanted to buy on your way home or whatever. So I was just asking myself, what if you have 10 million Africans, right? And every month they convince themselves that they lost $100 on their way home or on their way from the restaurant. That is $1 billion in 1 month, right? In 1 year, that's $12 billion. That's a lot of money. But then coming to the show, and I was asking myself, but what about we go beyond Africa? You know, we talk about climate change emissions and so on, but lifestyle emissions are huge. And there are so many people in the West who are richer, who want to do something about climate change, but they're a bit reluctant not to give up their lifestyle in exactly the way they would really want to. But they can do that if they also convince themselves that they will lose $100 every month, right? Now, you're going from 10 million Africans to maybe 100 million people globally, conveniently losing $100 a month. That is a lot of money that we can use to do a lot of clean energy development, especially in Africa and other developing countries. And I just, maybe you can even go from 100 million to about 1 billion people who can lose $100 in 1 month and don't feel any difference. What imagine the transformation that could bring in terms of the real investment that can go to countries that are really struggling. You know, because when we talked about investing in clean energy in countries, you know, we say the private sector, the money has got to come from the private sector. It will, but the private sector will always look for the easier projects. But development will only happen when we go to the most difficult places. So wouldn't this be a wonderful idea where everybody who feels comfortable puts $100 and that goes to close the energy gap with clean energy in the most difficult places globally?
It's a great thought. Like my brain is already going down a rabbit hole. I'm going to have to look up your piece. You said you put it up on LinkedIn. Is that what you said? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to have to read this because it's this idea of as we all transition. I know before I joined Columbia, I was working at the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation's Energy Research Center. And so you've got, you know, countries, what is it, from Russia to New Zealand, skipping a bunch in the middle, you know, on one side of the Pacific, and then Canada, US, Mexico, Chile, and Peru on the other side. And when I was meeting with the government officials in Papua New Guinea, 14% electrification, the Philippines, who, you know, NDC was conditional in terms of having financing and all that, and just the realities in different countries, thinking about how we all get there, so how the globe gets there. And these questions about how do we finance the role of public and private finance? What can we do to accelerate these transitions is just so critical in it. Oh, man. Linus, I hope we get to be on the show again together because I really want to talk through this. But okay. I'm going to do my free electrons really quick. I'm going to flag two very quickly. I'm going to pull Catherine, if you're listening, I'm taking a page out of your book. I'm doing two when I'm only supposed to have one. So first, for those of you who don't know already, I host this other podcast with the Center on Global Energy Policy that's called The Big Switch. And we just wrapped our season on how we decarbonize buildings. So existing ones that we have to retrofit and new ones, and the huge impacts of things like building codes and building standards, and what they can do in terms of accelerating or slowing down progress in an equitable transition to zero carbon buildings. And I'm flagging the episodes this week because it actually features one of my favorite people at Columbia University, Professor Michael Gerard, who earlier this month won a Lifetime Achievement Award from the New York Law Journal for his 40 plus years of environmental law and his career there in academia and private practice. And very, very well deserved. And I didn't have a crystal ball. I didn't know it was going to happen kind of in tandem with each other, but I just am thrilled that it did. So we can brag about and congratulate Professor Gerard. Michael, you're fantastic. So glad we're colleagues. So just wanted to share that with everyone here. The second one I'm going to flag is actually about water. So I used to work at the U.S. Department of Energy. And one of my good friends and former colleagues, Jennifer Garson, she heads up a lot of the work that they're doing around water and energy at DOE. And this shows how nerdy awesome my friend group is because we're texting about, you know, everything under the sun, including the fact that she's in North Carolina right now talking about wave power and desalination. So for those who haven't read about NREL's marine energy systems work that they're doing and this hydraulic and electric reverse osmosis wave energy converter device that's out there in the ocean, you should really check it out. And I just think about like energy water nexus. I studied under Michael Weber at UT Austin. It's always in my mind. And the solutions we're going to have, not just in terms of energy supplies, but harnessing energy to produce clean water, sanitation, going back to the sustainable development goals, Linus. It was fantastic and exciting seeing what she's doing this week. So just wanted to flag it.
Melissa, we always learn a new technology that I've never heard of in your free electron. And it's always exciting.
I'm glad to deliver because it's so cool, Robbie. It's nifty, and these innovations are they'll be normal someday. Maybe my kid will think they're normal in the future, which would be great. I just think they're so cool though. Well, with that, that's all the time we have for the Energy Gang this week. So I wanted to say thanks for joining us again today, Robbie. Good to see you.
Thanks, Melissa, and great to see you, Linus.
And Linus, it was really great having you on the show for today's discussion. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me on the Energy Gang. And thanks, Robbie, meeting you again. And I look forward to having another opportunity.
And thanks to each of y'all for listening. Please let us know what you thought about today's discussion and any suggestions you have on future topics. We are on Twitter at The Energy Gang, and I'm on Twitter at MCLOTT, MC Lott. The Energy Gang will be back in a couple of weeks with Ed back in this host chair with all the latest news and views on what's next for the energy transition. And until then, I hope that you have a great weekend. Bye, y'all.